And with dozens of settlers and soldiers together, you know, they came in, they threatened that if people didn't leave, they would be killed. And settlers and soldiers then tortured a number of Palestinians who were there. Soldiers attacked some Israeli activists who were there in a protective capacity, accusing them, you know, saying, why aren't you in Gaza? Why are you protecting terrorists? Nery Benghazi's lawyer had written in legal documents that he had extensive ties with the security establishment. You know, so this is well established, and you know the sort of, I mean, even in the UN, what I mentioned before, the 600 or so attacks that have happened since October 7th, the UN said that in at least half of those attacks, soldiers are present. You know, it's not a coincidence. It's not merely just soldiers not stopping these settlers. There is an active and ongoing collaboration between many of them.
And you say these sanctions do not address this.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they're targeting these individuals, you know, a handful of individuals out of hundreds who are attacking Palestinians, and sort of, you know, targeting them as individuals, but not the sort of state that is supporting them and encouraging them to continue to take land.
Journalist Shane Bauer's piece for The New Yorker is headlined, "The Israeli Settlers Attacking Their Palestinian Neighbors." And it's breaking news. The Irish Prime Minister has just resigned. I'm Amy Goodman.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
I'm Grace Gerling, Medicine Eagle Reed. I am broadcasting Negotiating Dramatic Events, a new show on KBOO, the third Wednesday at 9 a.m. I am a social justice activist since the 1960s. The purpose of the show is to make life more wonderful for me and the people around me. And I'm 80, and I'm going to take my elderliness and share what I have found so that everybody can be seen, heard, and understood. Negotiating Dramatic Events, the third Wednesday at 9 a.m. Thanks for tuning in. Really appreciate KBOO.
Hi, this is Peter Himmelman. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 8:02 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Rowland.
And good morning, everybody. This is Paul Rowland, and this is Wednesday Talk Radio. I had the wrong mic up. Sorry about that. And here we are live in the studio until 9 o'clock this morning. I'm getting a little fuzz back and a little weird feedback. You're not getting that? Okay, well, I guess that's just my my setup here. All right. So here we are live in the studios at KBOO Portland. Thanks, everybody, for contributing to our late winter membership drive. We really appreciate your support. And today we're going to be talking about The Great Unraveling and the Polycrisis with the author of a new report called The Great Unraveling, Navigating the Polycrisis of Environmental and Social Breakdown, with one of the co-authors of the report, Richard Heidenberg, who's a senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute, who is considered one of the world's foremost advocates for a shift away from our current reliance on fossil fuels. He's the author of 14 books, including some of the seminal works on society's current energy and environmental sustainability crisis, including Power, Limits, and Prospects for Human Survival, Afterburn, Society Beyond Fossil Fuels, The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality, Peak Everything, Waking Up to the Century of Declines, and many others. He's also written hundreds of essays and articles that have appeared in places like Nature, Reuters, The American Prospect, Yes, The Sun, and quite a few others. And we are very glad to have him on the phone this morning. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Paul. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you again.
Yes, we've had you on the show at least a couple times. And I know before that, I believe you were on Andrew Geller's show quite a few times. And it is so good to have you. Unfortunately, you're generally talking about, you know, what we do about the various crises that we're in. And, you know, talking about positive ways to respond. Unfortunately, it just seems like things keep getting worse. And now we are in what you and many others have been calling the polycrisis. So why don't we just start out by talking about what that is?
Right. Well, this is a new word that's kind of come into widespread use just in the last couple of years. World Economic Forum introduced it a couple of years ago, and then this year NPR chose it as one of their words of the year. So polycrisis, of course, indicates more than one existential risk converging at any given time. And, you know, human societies have been around for a long time, and they've always had problems, and sometimes those problems overwhelm societies. This is nothing new in a way, but in a sense it is, because of the scale of the risk that we're talking about. And we now have a global society that is facing global risks. It's no longer a case of just one, you know, small local society having to deal with famine or something like that. But we're looking at global problems, like, of course, climate change. But the term polycrisis, I think, is useful because it gets us out of the frame of thinking that it's really just all about climate change. I think many people with some environmental awareness these days tend to think of all of our environmental problems as being essentially circumscribed by climate change. So, you know, if we manage to reduce our carbon emissions, then we're good to go. Basically, you know, everything is fine, and we've succeeded. We have a long future ahead of us, and that's actually not the case. Our modern industrial economy is fundamentally unsustainable in a number of respects, climate change being just one of them. And unless we understand these other dimensions of the polycrisis and how they fit together and how they reinforce one another, then just going after carbon emissions or just, you know, building a lot of windmills and solar panels is not really going to have, we're not going to have that much success in dealing with our long-range problems. So that's the polycrisis in a nutshell.
Well, there's a lot of different directions we can go in, but I guess before we get into the sort of the specifics of it and like more in depth into some of the particular dimensions of what you're talking about. And of course, you're not just talking about environmental unraveling. You're also talking about social unraveling. It might be helpful for people if I just sort of go down the table of contents. So environmental unraveling, you include global warming, biodiversity and habitat loss, soil loss and degradation, water scarcity, chemical pollution, resource depletion, and then feedbacks and underlying drivers. Social unraveling, you say poverty, inequality, racism, and other forms of discrimination, antisocial responses to scarcity, authoritarianism, impacts of technological change, and again, feedbacks and underlying drivers. And then in the final section, then you go into the interaction between environmental and social drivers. And then weaving a new tapestry is the fifth chapter, how to respond to the great unraveling, and then what you can do. So that's what you set it up as. So we'll just less than an hour now, and I know we could talk for several hours in the first part. You talk about the origins of our predicament. Maybe you could just sort of do an elevator speech or whatever on what that is.
Sure. Well, we've created an economy that depends on constant growth in consumption, which means resource extraction and waste production. And also, part of that growth is also population growth. That's one of the factors of economic growth. So this is all seemed quite wondrous and marvelous for those of us who've been alive, especially the last 50, 75 years or so. We've enjoyed economic expansion on a scale that's never been seen before in all of human history. But we do live on a finite planet, and so increasing rates of resource extraction and waste dumping eventually results in problems, and those are the problems that we're starting to see now that are creating the polycrisis. One of the forms of waste we dump, of course, is CO2, causing climate change. Another thing that happens as the economy grows is that wealth inequality tends to increase. Those who own what Marx called the means of production tend to benefit the most from economic expansion, and then later on governments try to remediate increasing economic inequality as best they can through progressive taxation and government programs. But economic inequality, it's now being shown through historical social research the findings are not particularly new. I mean, they're intuitively obvious, but the research is new in the sense that it's happening on a scale with data from hundreds of ancient societies that we've never had access to before. And the findings are that, no surprise, increasing economic inequality leads to social instability. It leads to more competition among elites and to disaffection of those who aren't part of the elite classes. And so societies tend to fail. They tend to collapse after a certain degree of economic inequality is achieved. And we're seeing that in the world today, too. So why did all of this growth happen just in the last 50, 100 years or so? What's going on? Well, a lot of it has to do with fossil fuels. Energy is what enables us to do everything that we do. And fossil fuels gave us sources of energy that were completely unlike anything we had access to previously in terms of energy density, in terms of the minimal requirement of energy expenditure that was necessary in order to obtain a huge energy benefit. And so having, first of all, capitalism, in other words, private ownership of natural resources and protections for investors, having that in place, and then adding fossil fuels created both the rationale and the ability for societies to expand far more rapidly than was the case previously. And so we get these problems eventually. At first, it's all easy and fine. You know, society's expanding, economies are growing so fast that there's a certain amount of trickle-down of benefit. But beyond a certain point, and we're getting to that point, the consequences of rapid growth start to accumulate faster, the benefits start to disappear, and the consequences begin to roll in. The bills come due, as it were. And that's the essence of the polycrisis. That's the historical foundation for it.
So I don't know if you came across this fairly recent piece. Well, last October last year, by Thomas Homer Dixon on Vox. It's called "Why Is So Much Is Going Wrong at the Same Time." Lots of things are going wrong. Does that make it a polycrisis? Because I think it kind of sets aside, because you mentioned the World Economic Forum, and actually when I read that in this article, I was like, oh great, now they're talking about the World Economic Forum. So now the elites themselves are taking on this term that they themselves are basically perpetuating this crisis. So do we really trust even the term? Anyways, I think they frame it a really interesting, he frames it a really interesting way. I'll just read the first few paragraphs. Is the world facing a polycrisis? Is there even such a thing? First coined in the late 1990s, the term entered the zeitgeist earlier this year. That was last year, when polycrisis became the neologism du jour at the most recent World Economic Forum meeting in Davos. Its use evoked the world's current tangled mess of problems: pandemic, war, climate extremes, energy shortages, inflation, rising authoritarianism, and the like, and the term caught on. Inevitably, critics have multiplied since then, as have crises, such as the violence now convulsing Israel and Gaza. Those on the political center and right say the polycrisis concept is nothing more than a fancy buzzword. Sure, a lot of bad stuff is happening in the world, but that's always been the case, et cetera, et cetera. Then, meanwhile, critics on the left say that the polycrisis idea distracts attention, perhaps deliberately, from the real driver of humanity's traumas, relentless predatory globalized capitalism. The ruckus the term has sparked, though, suggests it's tapping some irksome truths. Anyway, and he goes on to make the case for the being the polycrisis. Yeah, but talk about a little bit about, you know, so what utility does it, what utility do you think this term actually has?
You brought up Thomas Homer Dixon because his institute, the Cascade Institute, is one of a small ecosystem of organizations, think tanks, that are now using the polycrisis frame for beginning to understand more broadly the confluence of problems and crises that are coming together. My organization, Post Carbon Institute, is another, the Omega Institute, and there are a few others. So this is becoming very quickly becoming a nexus of study of interest. And I think it's a useful frame because again, as I said at the beginning, it's a way of getting us out of this sort of carbon tunnel vision that sees climate change as the be-all and end-all of our global problematique, as the term was used back in the 1990s. When we have a fundamentally unsustainable global economy, then, you know, assuming that we can fix it just by tweaking a couple of variables like carbon emissions and renewable energy, I think is just a way of deluding ourselves, and there's no point in doing that. We are adults in the room, after all, and I think it's important for us to step back and look at the real problems. And even if there aren't easy solutions, you know, if if the problems exist, then we need to face them.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we continue, I'll repeat that I'm speaking with Richard Heinberg, a senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute, author of many groundbreaking books on the subjects of resource depletion, the fossil fuel crisis, the problem of fossil fuels in general. And we are speaking live on KBOO Community Radio, Wednesday Talk Radio. And this is a listener call-in show. And the number to call in at is 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. We're at 20 after the hour. We've got 40 minutes left, so don't wait until 10 minutes until 9 to call in, please, so we can you can get your full question or comment in. So why are we – I'm also looking at an article that you wrote for World Literature Today, From Climate Crisis to Polycrisis, which is exactly what you're talking about. And you talk about why we are failing to reduce or manage proliferating risks. And I don't know if you have that article at the tip of your tongue, as it were, but talk about why we are failing to reduce or manage proliferating risks.
Well, as crises start to pile up one on top of the other, it gets harder and harder for society to deal with each one of them adequately. And part of that happens because the crises are interacting. Things that we do to try to solve climate crisis, for example, tend to exacerbate either inequality or the problem of habitat destruction for other species. For example, with the climate crisis, we are trying to solve it by building massive new infrastructure for renewable energy. We're talking not just about solar panels and wind turbines, but electric cars, new manufacturing infrastructure, and so on. It's a massive enterprise, by far the biggest industrial project human beings have ever undertaken. Okay, so building all of this stuff is going to take massive amounts of raw materials that will have to be extracted in lots of places. We'll have to start new mines for lithium and cobalt and all of the other minerals that we'll be needing for the renewable energy transition. Many of those mining projects will be in poor communities. Many of them will impact habitat for other creatures. And so, you know, we're trying to solve one problem while exacerbating others. And you start examining the elements of the polycrisis, and you see these reinforcing impacts all over the place. There used to be a saying among ecologists, you can't do just one thing, because everything has repercussions. So that's kind of a pessimistic view of things. How are we ever supposed to solve any problem? Well, the essence of the problem that we're facing now has a lot to do with scale. You know, it's not just that we're using the wrong energy sources, i.e. fossil fuels instead of solar and wind power. It's that we're using so much energy, and there are so many of us using it. There's really no way to solve all of these problems rather than just, you know, playing one problem off against another without addressing the problem of scale, and that means looking at population and consumption. And we started off with the question, why are we failing to reduce or manage proliferating risks? It's largely because the problem of scale is being ignored. The assumption is, if we're going to solve the climate crisis, we have to replace fossil fuels with other energy sources that produce as much energy, as many energy benefits as fossil fuels do, so that we continue living essentially as we do now. But it's the scale of our energy usage that's part of the problem. And same thing with economic inequality. We try to solve it with economic growth. We have this belief, economists have this belief, that is, that a rising tide lifts all boats. If we have more economic growth, then everybody will benefit, even though the people at the top of the economic pyramid will, of course, benefit more than others. Well, that's not actually solving the problem. The problem is that as the economy grows, inequality actually gets worse, and economic growth is an inequality-generating machine. The only way to really get around that problem is to begin to unplug the machine. In other words, to imagine an economy that's not growing or that may be controllably contracting, at least for a certain amount of time, until we get that economy so that it's operating within Earth's natural limits. So we're not solving the problems because we're not framing them properly, and we're not willing to accept sacrifices.
Well, we have a couple callers. Jeremy and Sam, hold on just a second. I just sort of wanted to put out this idea that maybe we'll take up after the listeners have their say. But I mean, it comes down to power. You know, we're talking about energy as a form of power. But the other thing of power is social power. And once upon a time, there was the dream of a socialist society that could be brought about by either a peaceful transformation or a violent revolution. And we had a time when those things, large scale revolutions, did occur and did temporarily overturn an established order. Unfortunately, tended to just instate in a different way the same sort of in growth model that the capitalist societies did. But anyway, yeah. So the big burning question continues to be, after all this time, how does one actually change the because changing the scale means somewhere within the system there has to be some leverage point, some kind of effective way of making the transformation. And if the elites, the World Economic Forum, people who are using this term polycrisis, don't seem to be really serious about doing it that I can see, where is that going to come from? So hold that thought. But we do have first Jeremy up. Go ahead, Jeremy, you're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted to, I used one of my favorite words in neologism, and last I looked it up many, many years ago, it was usually people's using new words is driven by two things, either, you know, a large vocabulary and a knowledge of Greek or Latin, or it means you're insane and you're making up words. So I would argue that the good people who came up with the idea of polycrisis are, you know, the former. They're bright and interesting in coming up with a new idea because we sure need one. And then the bad people are insane because they think that they can, you know, build 200-foot yachts and drive their Musk mobiles into hell, you know, dragging the rest of us along with them.
Okay.
The other question I had was, as a self-anointed eco saint, I've basically never driven, and I've been a vegetarian for 2/3 of my long life. I was always told that those are the two most important things to do, and then I got rid of all my old appliances. Is that still correct? That mass agricultural production of meat and driving are the two worst things that we do.
Okay, thanks, Jeremy.
Thank you.
Well, actually, in terms of carbon emissions, the one thing you can do probably to eliminate the most carbon emissions is have one fewer offspring. And then the next thing you can do is become a vegetarian, and the next thing after that is stop flying. Stop driving a car comes right after that, and then the list goes on. But it's really surprising how big an impact just having one fewer offspring actually has in terms of your carbon legacy. And it's sad that we've really stopped talking about overpopulation, even as we continue to add roughly 80 million people to the world's rolls every year. And that's not an insignificant number.
Let's go to Sam. You're up next. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question on how you feel about the idea that, especially in terms of like, well, we can't always be growing, can't be expanding, and all the problems that that creates. Some economic thinkers would say that capitalism is basically just a theory, and as long as we have new markets to exploit, external labor forces with different price points, that we can always keep expanding and it works. But I understand that it's theoretical in the sense that, like, say here in Portland, if it was a smaller town, everyone worked at, say, the Nike factory. If you can't work at the Nike factory and Nike can't make a profit at a price point where a worker in the factory can buy the shoe, that is, in a closed economic system, the capitalism would not work and would fall apart. And I'm wondering how you feel about that concept, or if it's been proven otherwise, because in the idea that we have to get ready to for economy that isn't growing all the time, the idea is that we're constantly engaging in wars, and our foreign policy is basically dominated by resource geology and markets that we're after, because we need raw materials at cheaper prices than our market has, and we need labor at cheaper prices than our market has, because ultimately we can't make these goods and have these goods be afforded by the workers making the goods.
Okay.
Is that a truism?
Yeah, I mean, that's what Marx pointed out back in the 19th century, and he was basically correct, but the absurdities of economic theory, accepted mainstream economic theory, don't stop there. The whole idea of private property private ownership of natural resources is what I'm talking about here. I mean, people should be able to own the fruits of their own labor, but we don't produce rivers and streams and mineral deposits and so on. Those are gifts of nature. So how do some people get to own those things and profit from them? It's a given of modern economic theory and capitalism, but if you start really thinking about it in any kind of ethical way, it's absurd. And any member of any indigenous community anywhere on the planet looks at that and says, "Wait, that's crazy." I mean, literally crazy. And we could go on. I mean, modern economic theory. I grabbed a little. A little icon off of Investopedia one time that is a representation of the economy, and it has producers and consumers, and their exchange is mediated with money, and that's the economy. That actually is the economy in most economists' minds, but in reality, the economy has to exist within a finite planet. Where do all the resources come from that get processed to be made into products that result in the monetary exchanges? They come from the earth. So the economics should begin with a study of natural processes, natural limits, ecology, and then the economic processes that take place within society need to be seen within that context. What is possible? What is useful? What is beneficial within that larger context of the ecosphere?
Well, thank you, Sam and Jeremy. Go ahead. You had one more question. Go ahead. One more.
I have a follow-up question to that. So to your point, and that's very poignant, the concept of, you know, natural capital and how it's not even accounted for in our economic system. So that leads me to this question. When we use this broad lens and we're saying we need to do this as far as our energy, where it comes from, we need to, what we are doing, is that in a sense a disservice and watering down the real conversation of who is doing this and by what means? Going, you know, I would look at like, well, wow, we didn't even have inflation going vertical on the chart till we did away with the gold standard. Why did we do that? Who benefits from inflation? What are these leverage points? And I know it's a much more divisive conversation at that point, but when we use this lens of like, we need to do this, that's not even the system we're working with. And there's the power positions that are making the decisions are not trying to solve these problems. And that is a big part missing when we have these very open liberal discussions that don't really look at who is doing this and what are their leverage points to our, you know, within our government.
Okay, excellent question, sure. Sam. Go ahead, Richard.
Yeah, sure. You're absolutely right. Who is making the decisions? The people with social power. Where does social power come from? It's a long story, and it starts back in the early days of states and kings, with the invention of some tools like metal weaponry, money, and communication technology, starting with writing. So wherever you find social power in the modern world, you find a nexus of those things: weapons, communication technologies, and money. So whoever controls those is basically making the decisions. And as I argue in my book, Power, we're not going to be able to get around this flurry of existential crises that we're naming now the polycrisis. We're not going to be able to get around this without confronting power. Human power over the environment, and also the power of some people to control other people by means of communication technologies, weapons, and money. That's the ball game, and we find ways of kicking the can down the road of ignoring power inequality, of covering up for it, of saying, oh, it's actually a good thing, and so on. But that doesn't work. It only perpetuates the crises and causes them to get worse until we get to the point where the whole thing falls apart. And you know, other societies reach that stage. In fact, the other societies reach that stage at some point or another. The difference is that now we have a global industrial society, about 8 billion people on the brink of what could be conditions of extra violence and human suffering unless we somehow find a way to these problems.
Okay. Thank you, Sam. Well, I imagine Santiago might have something to say on that point, and then I did want to go a little bit of a different direction. Go ahead, Santiago. You're on the air.
Good morning. I like that you pointed out about, I think polycrisis is kind of just another way of marketing something. It's like calling the flu the multi-symptom sickness, you know? It's like we have to be able to name what it is, and I think when you call it polycrisis, it ignores the fact that it's literally just like capitalism, you know, because we're consuming more than we actually need to use. But more importantly, I think it's really I think another thing that is a real big driver of all this is that a lot of the philosophies that have dominated the Western world, which has dominated the entire world, literally and figuratively. Has operated on the assumption or the assumption, the false understanding that somehow humans are separate from nature. You know, because when we talk about saving the environment, we think of the environment as this lush green, like, you know, oasis somewhere. But environment is literally just where we're standing, you know? It's not, we're not separate from it, you know? You know, a lot of theologians are like, well, we're not monkeys. We didn't come from apes. It's like, no, we are apes. We are a part of the circle. And I think that's part of the reason why people have such a hard time, you know, especially with the trying to move to a different mode of production that is more cooperative than exploitive, because we want to see ourselves as something that's above and over based on how we've been indoctrinated into the system.
Okay.
So, and then one more thing to point out, too, you know, when it comes, because, you know, Paul had made a comment earlier about how there were, you know, there were revolutions that attempted to change the way things were done. The reason why a lot of those didn't work is because we still had capitalist boots on our necks everywhere in the world, and it's always been the driver of who has had the most money based on how this world is put together. So if we're going to really change things, we got to stop the war machine here. We got to stop the war machine here in the West.
Okay, thank you, Santiago. Go ahead, Richard.
Yeah, well, Santiago made a great point, which is that we tend to view the environment or nature as being something apart from ourselves, and that's a big part of the problem. Absolutely, and this, you know, this is something we experience on a moment-by-moment basis. We tend to spend more and more of our time looking devices, held computers or computers on our desks or screens of one kind or another. We live in buildings manufactured with industrial processes and get outside less and less. We live more in cities. More people now live in areas and it's never happened before in all of human history. So we are more and more cut off from nature by virtue of our own technologies and social arrangements, and then that reinforces the beliefs and the assumptions in our heads that say that nature is separate from ourselves and something that, you know, may have some utility as, you know, a place to go vacations or something like that. But otherwise, it's just a pile of raw materials to be exploited so that we can keep living the way we are with handheld devices and cars and airplanes and so on, which is the real world. That's the important world, because it's the world that generates a profit for the people with power. So, that whole way of thinking is and they often ask, well, what is the alternative? And quite frankly, after decades of thinking of the fundamental unsustainability of industrial economies and production, the only answer is re-indigenizing ourselves in places where we are, learning the ecological rules and boundaries and limits to those places, reaccustoming ourselves to those limits, and a culture that honors nature, that protects nature, and that that makes life fun again. I mean, I don't think modern industrial life is much fun, frankly. It's we're not happy. I mean, there are all kinds of surveys now to test human happiness and who are the happiest places, who are the happiest people, and so on. And people, well, first of all, the United States is not a very happy country by those measures. But you go to some place like Bhutan, where people are still living what we would call a third world or a non-industrialized lifestyle, and the level of happiness are actually much higher. So the solution, and the solution would be indigenizing ourselves.
Okay, we do have about 15 minutes left. We have a couple callers, and I wanted to get some other subjects in, or basically take it in a slightly different direction. But let's hear what Janine has to say. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi. I came of age in the Back to the Land hippie era, and my big takeaway from it is living a life of voluntary simplicity. And it's, you know, you were talking about industrial culture not being very healthy or happy, and voluntary simplicity tends to lead to more satisfying lifestyles and more cooperative, self-sufficient, and, you know, the culture was heading that direction in the 70s. You know, Carter brought in E.F. Schumacher with his notions of small as beautiful. We were conserving energy and using solar panels, and then, you know, the corporate world just squashed it. But the solution is still a good one, voluntary simplicity. Like Einstein says, the best solution to a problem is the simplest one and nothing simpler.
Well, let me jump on that before I turn it over to Richard. Thank you, Janine. That kind of gets to something I wanted to sort of follow up on from some earlier questions and comments, and some things we touched on in the conversation already. Jeremy talking about, you know, being a vegetarian, not driving a car, et cetera. There's sort of a theme that I've touched on repeatedly in this program over the years is the idea of individual approaches, individual solutions or attempts to solve things versus collective ones. And that kind of touches on the discussion of revolutionary thought or, you know, large scale transformations, whether violent or nonviolent. Also the question that you talked about scale. And I think there's also a question of time involved here, which is becoming more and more pressing, given some of the recent spate of studies. It seems to be accelerating as the climate change accelerates and the degradation of the ecosystems accelerate. The study of them is more and more people are catching. There's people of various disciplines studying this stuff, and the studies are showing that the rate of change itself is accelerating, and so the time frame we have within which to address these poly crisis seems to be diminishing. So the question, we get back to the question of power. So I believe in voluntary simplicity. That's been a big part of my life. And a lot, the milieu that I kind of came of political age in, sort of the environmental movement, the kind of cutting edge at the time, the Earth First movement. And that was, pretty much how most of us thought and hopefully still think. But it hasn't really influenced things because, as Janine said, it got squashed by the people in power who have the money, communication, et cetera. So the question still is, what form of individual, collective, whatever kind of action, what form actually has a chance of even beginning to stem the tide of the poly crisis?
Mm-hmm. Well, I can suggest three things, and all three are radical. I don't think that there's any way of addressing the poly crisis that could that has any chance of success that's not radical. So here are three radical things that I think could help. One is rationing. Resources will become more scarce as time goes on, and especially if we try to deal with problems like climate change, there's no way to do that without reducing energy usage. Rationing our remaining fossil fuels is the obvious, duh, thing we should be doing.
Well, let me just jump in, Richard, because that gets back at this. It basically begs the same question. Is there has to be some change in the power dynamics in order to institute the kind of rationing you're talking about. So it's basically the same question over and over again. How do you actually get to a point where either the people in charge are, enlightened and can, whoever wrote that book, Natural Capitalism, his idea was, you can have an enlightened capitalism, et cetera. That's obviously not happening. Or you have a popular revolution or, some sort of massive ground up shift where people are instituting these changes on local levels, regional levels, But that's not happening. So it's still the same question, is how do you actually have some kind of change in the power dynamics?
Yeah. Well, you know, realistically, it's too late for massive top-down change. We had that opportunity, as Janine was saying, back in the 1970s, and there was the possibility of that happening. But at this point, far too late for that kind of shift to happen. So what we're talking about, reorganizing society in the context of gradual collapse. And, gradual is not the right word. Intermittent, stochastic, uncontrolled collapse. Finding ways to exert control during phases of collapse to avert the worst consequences and create the most opportunities. And actually, within that context, rationing makes a lot of sense as a local strategy. It, of course, obviously, it would be better as a national strategy, but if that is impossible, if it doesn't happen, then on a local basis. Same thing with land reform. We desperately need land reform because right now so much land is tied up in the hands of so few people and corporations, and mostly the old people in my generation, so-called baby boomers, control most of the land in the United States. And we have lots of idealistic young people who would like to go into farming because they see that as an honorable way to spend their lives, and they understand that our food system is fundamentally unsustainable and that ecological farming could make a difference, but they don't have access to land. Land's too expensive. So some kind of land reform is absolutely essential. And if we can't do it on a national basis, find ways to do it locally. What was my third point?
What I was waiting for, but that's okay. We'll come back to you. We only have a few minutes left, and we got a couple callers still. So let's go to let's see what Art has to say. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello.
Go ahead.
Hi, Richard. I've been writing an essay. It's called The Walking Communities of 2040, and it kind of addresses the main concerns about energy production and then transport and travel and land use. And I sent it down to the Post Carbon Institute office. It's in Eugene area.
Yeah, it's Corvallis, right? Our mailing address.
I wondered if you got the Walking Communities essay. You got a chance to read it. So it's been about a year though since I sent it down there.
Yeah, I lived in Northern California, and it hasn't made it through the post to my mailbox yet. But I'll email the folks in Corvallis and see if it arrived, and they can forward it to me.
As I said, it's been a more than a year since that.
Well, okay.
My goodness.
We only have a few minutes left, so we're going to give some other people a chance to talk. Okay, thank you, Art. Mark, what do you got to say?
Yes, hello. In this conversation, it's been mentioned a few times that it's really difficult to find out how to unseat the current power. And nobody's talked about the monetary system quite yet, that is the basis of their power. You know, when you start talking about fiat systems, these are ways of which they finance wars, they, take over property, buy things, indiscriminately, and nobody's talked yet about how to unseat that power. And one way that is happening right now, and it's, I'd like, one folk like Santiago to maybe pay more attention to this, and that is Bitcoin. Bitcoin is a way to unseat this fiat monster that we depend on, and they depend on, in order to enslave everybody else.
Okay, Richard, what do you have to say about Bitcoin?
Yeah, I'm not that optimistic about Bitcoin serving as a real alternative to our current monetary system. I do remember the third radical thing I was going to say, and that's debt forgiveness across the board, especially the poor nations versus rich nations. but also, you know, we have a huge debt overhang right now, where for the last, especially about the last 25, 30 years, debt creation has just gone exponential, and there's no way all of that debt is going to be forgiven, and it's a means of modern slavery. So getting rid of all that debt would actually destroy an enormous amount of fictitious wealth that creates, you know, temporary billionaires. And, you know, nobody should be a billionaire. We don't need any billionaires in the world. So I think the fastest way of getting rid of them all without, you know, doing it physically would be just making their wealth go away by forgiving a lot of debt.
Okay. I wanted to get in the last couple minutes to this deeper into this question of the time scale. There's been a remarkable increase of reports about the rate of a change of climate. I know it's just one among the many crises that we're facing, but it seems to be happening now at such a fast rate that it's truly mind-boggling. So the Greenland ice sheet is now shedding 30 million tons of ice per hour. It was per day, which was already just shocking just a year ago. And now, and this is a recent article by Robert Hunsaker, who's been one of the few people really hitting constantly at these issues. This is on Counterpunch, March 15th. That's one. And the other is the mind-boggling rate of increase of the temperatures of the oceans. I think the last 12 months, there's been daily records broken every day for like 12 months, and it's so we're risking just a complete shift in our global weather patterns, in our global currents, breakdown of the current that sends a warm water to the UK, and potentially, you know, just massive repercussions this year. I was so bold as to say last week, I think we're going to see some just shocking things happen this year on the climate front. So just the time scale, it's really hard for people to wrap their heads around.
I know. I'm afraid you're right about that. Last year, 2023, saw a global temperature increase of 0.2 degrees Celsius. And, you know, for a sense of scale, you know, we're talking about hopefully being able to limit total global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. To have 0.2 degrees in just 1 year makes that goal just basically impossible. We're headed beyond 2 degrees. And what that actually means for the planet, for human civilization, nobody knows at this point, but we're headed into a new climate regime that's completely different from anything that civilization has known before. And we're doing this, we're risking all future human generations just so that we can maintain this momentary blip of industrial economy with airplanes and smartphones and so on. We're so enamored with this moment of history that we're willing to risk not only the future of humanity, but the future of the biosphere.
And it seems that the people who are in that bubble of maintaining the as I call it, the mega machine, as it heads to a big crash, they seem to be still under the illusion that they can manage it, this polycrisis, or that they just don't understand it. They don't think, because I think still a lot of people think that we just can't have that big an impact on the Earth's systems, which is...
Right, yeah. Well, obviously we are having that big an impact. The problem is nobody is in charge at this point. I mean, we can point to the global elite and name, you know, Elon Musk and a few other people, and these are extraordinarily powerful individual human beings, but the reality is push one of them aside and somebody else will take their place almost instantly. It's the system itself, and it's the system is highly, ironically, the system is resilient, even though it's undoing the resilience of all of our natural systems. So that, sadly, I don't see a way of unseating this current power structure fast enough to avert some form of collapse, social and ecological collapse, and I think it's already underway.
That is a brilliant point that I wish we'd touched on. Maybe we'll have to have you back fairly soon. The paradoxical resilience of a system that is undermining the resilience of the basis for life on the planet. Shocking. So Richard Heinberg, this has been really great, and I definitely will invite you back on in the near future. This has been really a stimulating conversation.
Well, thank you, Paul.
Yeah, thank you so much. Again, postcarbon.org is where you can find out more about Richard's work and the work of the Post Carbon Institute. And I will put up some more links on my website at kboo.fm, Wednesday Talk Radio. Thanks again, Richard.
My pleasure. Thank you, Paul.
Okay. And that's it for Wednesday Talk Radio. Thanks for listening and calling in, everybody. Bye-bye.
Eternal flames of hell, hellfire. I said doctrines of the fallen angel, no water to quench eternal flames of hell, hellfire. Earth crisis, earth crisis, all is suffering, earth crisis.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 9 a.m.
Thanks for listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM in the Portland metro area and all over the world at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934